Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm a Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by my colleagues David Robertson and Malcolm Kay, who are Senior Research Fellows at the OIAS. And we're here today to discuss the key themes and messages that came from the inaugural Energy Transition Days that were held in Oxford and live-streamed on the 21st to 22nd of June 2022. Now, the podcast today follows the one from last week, which I did with Jim Henderson, and that addressed the non-electricity themes and messages that came from the same meetings. Now, just to timestamp this podcast, we're recording it on the afternoon of Wednesday, the 6th of July, 2022. David and Malcolm, welcome back to the OIAS podcast series.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone.
Oh, that was brief. Nice to have you here, guys. Okay. Now, the two key issues discussed at the meetings in Oxford were, of course, two issues central to the energy transition: the need for fundamental structural reform of electricity markets and new approaches to energy networks. So may I suggest that we address these two in turn? Now, so first, let's talk about markets. And perhaps I can start with you, David. Now, do you think that the energy price and security crisis will mean that there is less interest in the energy transition? Or could it accelerate that transition and the need to prepare for it, especially in the electricity sector, which will become the dominant source of energy?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. It's, first of all, clear that the price spike, or that is very high prices of gas and electricity, plus the security crisis, have taken center stage, and that right now the sustainability objective and energy transition seems to be on the back burner, in certainly in Europe and I think in the UK. It's inevitable that certainly in Europe they're scrambling to replace Russian fossil fuel, in particular natural gas, and looking for gas and for alternative sources of energy, including, say, in particular coal-fired power and nuclear power, to replace the gas which is no longer coming from Russia, and which they're in any case trying to reduce the imports of. It's also inevitable that with prices rising so very much for electricity and gas, that governments are looking for ways to cushion the blow for especially the most vulnerable customers, but in many countries for most customers, including industrial and residential customers. So I think that that there is a clear shift in priority, or at least if you think of the three objectives of energy policy being energy security, reasonable prices, and sustainability has taken a back seat. On the other hand, I think what we've seen is that very high prices and the insecurity of imported fossil fuels has reinforced the case for an energy transition which would enable Europe and I think the UK to rely more on their own resources, and in particular on renewable energy. So I think what we're seeing is not just that this is sort of reinforcing the sense that that's relevant, but it's actually creating a new constituency for the energy transition. We no longer have just those who are interested in decarbonization and in, if you want, in addressing climate change, but we now have a security element to it. And also, as I say, a great concern about the impact on prices of relying on imported fossil fuels, whose prices can be determined in what would only be described as oligopolistic markets, where the suppliers have, in some sense, a reason to want to restrict supply rather than to supply more. So I think that's the beginning of it. The logic of the European response that is in is called Repower EU is sort of evidence of this, of the importance being given to accelerating the energy transition in order to provide energy security. And in particular, the focus is on renewable electricity, electrification, and the development of renewable sources of gas, especially green hydrogen and biomethane. But essentially what we're talking about is a system which is going to replace reliance on imported fossil fuels with reliance on decarbonized sources of energy, and in particular electricity. What we're talking then about is replacing one form of security of energy supply, which is based upon geopolitics and in some sense is no longer recognized as being secure, with another source of energy security, which is domestic, but which relies very heavily on the electricity system, which raises serious questions about whether Europe's own energy markets and its regulations are fit for purpose, and whether they will provide the basis for developing a genuinely secure alternative to today's reliance on fossil fuels.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that, David. So perhaps I could now come to you, Malcolm, because you wrote some time ago that the current electricity markets were not fit for purpose. Could you perhaps explain to our listeners why that is the case?
It's quite simple, really. The current electricity market was designed around 20th century technologies. We're moving into a new era dominated, as we've heard, by sources like variable renewable sources like wind and solar. Now, markets are based on short-run marginal cost. That is the cost of producing an extra unit of electricity in the very short term. Now, in a traditional electricity system, to do that, you'd have to burn some gas or burn some coal. So there was a cost in doing that. You could look at the price of gas or coal and the price of electricity and decide if it was worth using that to generate electricity. It doesn't work like that with wind and solar. They produce when the wind is blowing or the sun is shining, whatever the price is. And if the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining, however high the price is, they can't decide to produce. So it's a completely different structure. And the outcome of that is that present markets don't work as markets are supposed to. They don't give good signals to investors. And you've seen that in that most investment is now underpinned by government support for renewables or capacity payments. They don't give good signals for operation because renewables have priority, so they operate when they're available, but not when they're not. They don't give good signals for consumers because the costs of all these extra elements, that is renewables support, capacity payments, the higher balancing costs that come with variable supply, are simply spread onto consumer prices in a more or less unmeaningful way. And the biggest problem, to my mind, is that there is no exit strategy. The higher the penetration of variable renewables, the more markets are unable to operate, the higher the subsidies for renewables have to be, and the further you get away from a sensible market structure.
Okay, so David, perhaps coming back to you then, what do you think the main contending alternatives are to address the challenges of electricity market reform? And if the priority is to encourage low carbon investment, won't market reform just create uncertainty and delay?
Well, yeah, let me start by identifying at a high level three alternative views on how to proceed, on how to deal with the problems that Malcolm has identified, which are particularly important in the case of investment, because if renewable energy is increasingly at the margin, setting the short-run marginal cost or price in the market, these prices will get lower and lower, and investors will see little point in investing. So there are three, as I say, alternative views on how to proceed. And the first one is represented, I think, best by ACER, which is an agency for the coordination of energy regulators in Europe. And their view is, has always been, that we do not need fundamental structural reform. We should accept that the current energy-only market is basically a suitable market for the future, and we just need to improve it. And by improvement, they usually mean prices which reflect location more accurately, or which have more granularity in terms of timing. That it, in other words, they will be much more related to short-term, sort of just about to happen dispatch, rather than a day ahead or longer periods of time. But above all, and I think this is a central point, is they insist on the importance that prices be allowed to spike whenever there's a shortage. And in that case, even though prices may be low most of the time, they say, yes, but the prices will be high enough from time to time, and that will help to recover or will enable the companies to recover their investment costs. Well, that may have been true in the past, but it is certainly questionable right now. And when you look at what's happening around Europe, you can see governments intervening to cap prices whenever they do spike. So the idea, I think, is that investors will be very nervous about assuming that prices will be high enough in general, and they will be also nervous about the prospect of governments intervening whenever they are high. So I think that model is not going to fly. I don't think it's sustainable, and I think we can see already some cracks in it in the latest report by Acer. The second approach is really the status quo in many countries, which is the central buyer model. And in that model, governments decide what should be built, what mix and how much, and then they use auctions or other competitive mechanisms to decide who will build it. So they don't really leave decisions about the mix or the amount to markets. The government decides. Now, this has some important advantages, which is why it's popular with companies, I think, and also with governments. One is that governments can ensure that the investment occurs. They're going to ensure that it does. And when we need to make sure there is investment in low carbon energy, we want to be sure that it will happen. They can also use their guarantees in these contracts that they offer to the winners of the auctions to reduce the cost of project capital. So in effect, they're lowering the cost of meeting their objectives. And they also can support technologies which otherwise wouldn't get built because they're not economic in the market, particularly for reasons that Malcolm has described, which is that the market isn't actually giving the right signals. So there are a number of advantages to it, but there's one major drawback. We call it capital inefficiency, which is namely the enormous cost of governments getting it wrong. Now, in the UK, an example of that, which most people will point to, is the recent decision to build 8 new nuclear reactors before 2050 to supply 25% of UK electricity. Now, in the wake of the enormous overruns on the Hinkley C nuclear power stations, it's really hard to not see this as one of those, a good example of a potential huge waste of capital. So I think the thing we have to remember is that the reasons governments have been able and been willing to do it in the past was that they have poor incentives. The first is that they don't want the lights to go out ever, because politically that's not acceptable, so they will tend to overbuild. The second is that they don't have to bear the cost. There'll probably be some future government to deal with the problem if it arises, but they also are able to pass the cost through to consumers. And yet that used to be true, but may not be true now because consumers have choices. If the costs are extremely high and consumers have alternatives to self-generate, for instance, with their own batteries to store their electricity, then the government will have great difficulty passing on the costs to those consumers. So I think that this model is, inevitably going to continue for a while because so many contracts are tied to it. But the idea that it is the long-term optimal is simply wrong. The third approach, I call it liberalization 2.0, and it involves the same logic as the original liberalization, which is to rely on competition and private investors to drive investment with governments designing the markets to encourage effective competition while protecting vulnerable customers and financing uneconomic technologies and regulating monopolies. So we basically have a reason, I think, to be beginning to move back to the liberalization concept that underlies UK legislation and all EU legislation as well. Now, this model worked initially, but when it was clear that there was a fundamental market failure in the form of not reflecting the costs of fossil fuels, that is CO2 costs, governments had to intervene in order to ensure that the investment would take place in technologies which at the time were totally uneconomic. So there was a justification for central purchasing and government support for these technologies. But that doesn't mean that one needs to continue with that model forever. As the costs come down for renewables and for flexibility to integrate the renewables, and as we see more and more new business models and new technologies which integrate consumer demand and consumer, if you want, electric vehicles and heat pumps and storage and batteries into the system, we see that there's more and more players, more and more competitors in the market, and less need for central control. Indeed, the central control could be absolutely out of whack with what consumers are want. And since consumers will now be in a position to, in effect, privatize their own security of supply, the system may end up with an excess capacity whose costs cannot be recovered. So basically, I would argue that we're really talking now about moving towards the liberalization 2.0. But to come back to your first, your second question, which was, you know, given the priority of encouraging low carbon investment, won't reform, you know, create uncertainty and delay? And the answer is yes, it's important not to think that from one day to the next, we're going to change the whole system. It's a question of defining where we're going and then making sure that the reforms that are happening on the way are in line with where we're going, but not getting rid of important contractual arrangements that exist now between government and investors. No, rather maintain them, but start to move in the direction. And there's many ways to do it with pilot projects. You can have auctions just for certain sorts of renewable technology. But the bottom line here is that we're not talking about changing things overnight. We're talking about a transition, but knowing in what direction we're going and whether the reforms we're making are taking us there or not.
Malcolm, if I can come to you, but surely consumers are only concerned with low prices and simple tariffs. What is the evidence, therefore, that they would respond to restructured price signals?
I think traditionally, certainly, both governments and the electricity industry, I'm afraid, have treated consumers as passive. And one of the problematic outcomes of that has been that decarbonisation has simply been something that's been done to consumers. They haven't been able to play any part in it or take any advantage of it. Now, you may be right that consumers are interested in low prices and simple tariffs, but we think you can offer them that while encouraging decarbonisation. There's something perverse about the fact that renewables prices are coming down all the time, yet consumer electricity prices are going up all the time. If you could offer consumers a way of accessing those lower renewable prices, they might well like it. If you could offer it in a nice, simple way, they might well be prepared to adjust their behavior. And in fact, there is quite a lot of historic evidence that people can change their electricity consumption as long as the offerings to them are simple. For instance, the Economy 7 tariff in the UK and the Creuse tariff in Paris, which in France, which offered significantly lower prices at night, really changed the profile of consumers' load and offered great advantages. It's difficult to do under the present market arrangements, but we think that if you change the market structures, introduce simple new tariff structures, separated out renewables costs and fossil fuel costs, you could see a big change in consumer behaviour.
Okay, so now let's move to the second subject area, networks. And perhaps I can stay with you, Malcolm, first on this. You know, why are networks so important for the energy transition?
They're important because we might well need new networks, but we don't at this stage know exactly what new networks we'll need or how big they are. So this is a big challenge for policy. We might need networks, for instance, for hydrogen or perhaps to convert existing gas networks to hydrogen. We might need networks for heat. We might need networks for carbon dioxide if carbon capture is going to be part of the future system. So governments need some way of thinking about what networks to build, where to build them, what their functions will be, and so on. And these are challenges governments haven't had to face for some time. All the networks in all OECD countries were built under conditions of vertically integrated monopoly. We've now got a competitive market, and no one has really faced the issue of how do you develop networks in an efficient way in that sort of market. And that's why I think they're very important, because to optimize the future system, we're going to have the not just the right fuels, but the right mix of networks. So we need to find some way of doing that.
David, you know, with the growth of distributed generation, the flows on the distribution networks will be obviously increasingly hard to predict. How do you think this uncertainty should be managed?
Well, as you say, the growth of distributed generation creates the possibility for a reversal in flows in the distribution network. It used to be the case that the generation was at the transmission level and that it always flowed in one direction from that transmission network into the distribution network to the final consumer. But when the final consumers and others have generation which is on the distribution network, there may be times when flows will go in the opposite direction, leaving the distribution network to go into the system, and where there may be great uncertainty about that. And times when there is so much congestion that the system, you know, simply has to either cut off some consumers or have very poor service. So what previously distribution companies would do when there was a problem of congestion was they would build more network. The problem is that today, to try to cope with all of the uncertainty that there is would be vastly more expensive than anyone could justify. So the challenge has been, well, how do we manage the uncertainty without having to build new networks? And the answer is different from one country to another, but the essential answer in most European countries is to develop what are called local flexibility markets. So in those flexibility markets, this could be for investment or for operation, so for a long term or for a short term, and many different potential suppliers of flexibility. They could be generators, they could be distributed, they could be consumers, they could be aggregators that aggregate a number of consumers, that they can provide flexibility to the distribution company, and the distribution company can use the market to figure out who is going to provide them in the long term with flexibility and who can provide them next Tuesday with flexibility. So I think that's the key, these flexibility markets. But the other two keys are that the distribution company has incentives to promote the cheapest, the least most cost efficient solution, rather than if you want to develop its own assets. And that's a regulatory issue. But the final one is to make sure that there's room for new agents to come in with new technologies, which allow, for instance, the aggregation of all these different distributed energy resources to provide them, because right now most consumers are not in a position to do it themselves.
Malcolm, coming back to you, if I can, you know, what do you think the main challenges are in setting up new networks?
The main challenges are, in one sense, as they always have been. It's to do with the economics of networks. Basically, they show what economists call constant economies of scale. That is, the bigger they are, the lower the unit cost. Now, one consequence of that is that the most efficient thing to do is to build a monopoly, so they require regulation. And I think people understand that. But another consequence is that it's very difficult when you're setting up a new network to know how to size it, I mean, how big it should be, because really the most efficient size will be as big as the eventual demand for moving a product through that network will be. But that's always quite difficult to determine. It creates a problem that while the network is building up, the network operator will be running at a loss and you have to find some way through that. But there's an additional problem in the networks I've been talking about, that is, say, hydrogen and carbon dioxide, in that they're not in themselves economic. They are essentially, or would essentially be, driven by government policies. And that makes it very difficult to decide on the right size of a network in a situation where many government policies are uncertain as to the long term. For instance, in the UK, the government hasn't even decided yet whether it will ever want a hydrogen network to replace the gas network for local heat services.
Well, Malcolm and David, you know, as you may know, I always like to end a podcast with a forward-looking question. And over the last 25 minutes or so, you know, we've talked over a lot of issues. So my question is, you know, really, where will it all end up? On what signals should our listeners look out for? So, David, why don't I come to you first and then ask Malcolm. David, what are your views?
Okay, well, let me look at this from the European perspective and to begin. I think there's two, possibly three big issues to keep an eye out on. The first is the debate over market design. And currently that debate in Europe focuses exclusively on the short-term very high prices. There's almost no discussion about the longer term problems that markets will face in order to attract investment. So the things that we've been talking about today are pretty absent from the debate. And there's a risk of mixing up these two debates and thinking that solving problems in the short run, which usually involves intervening in markets, capping prices, and making decisions that are not consistent, if you want, with long-term investment signals, that those will replace a discussion or displace the discussion about where we really need to go. So I think it'd be interesting for the listeners to see whether or not in Europe the discussion continues to focus just on the short term, or they really start to talk about a separate topic, which is the longer term requirements. The second major European issue has to do with interconnectors, and in particular, whether Northern European countries will be willing and able to finance renewables and green hydrogen from Southern Europe, where costs are much lower. Because to date, that has not been the case, partly because of the difficulty of agreeing over whether to build interconnectors and who will pay for them, but also because national governments will generally support national renewables, even if they are more expensive than imported renewables. So it will be interesting to see if the EU is able to overcome the barriers to this sort of efficient trade. That would definitely be a move in the right direction. And I guess that brings me to my last point, which is a more general one, which is that Europe has tension between the central European responsibility for energy markets and the national member state responsibility for energy resources. And that tension continues to, if you want, to make very difficult the sorts of interconnector and trade decisions that I've been describing. It also influences the nature of the market design one wants. Question is going to be, will the crisis that we're now facing and the need to come up with a European solution, which is integrated and which is actually going to provide security of supply, reasonable price, as well as fighting climate change, whether that is going to be now possible because of this pressure, and they're going to be able to overcome the tension that now exists between the center and the member states.
Malcolm, your views?
Well, I'll focus on the UK. In the UK, I think there are two quite important signals coming up as to where things are going. The first, if the government survives, that is, until summer recess, it's due to produce a consultation paper on a review of electricity market arrangements. And it will be interesting to see there how far the government has really grasped the fundamental nature of the problem and is prepared to think about fundamental solutions. There are signs that it is doing so. For instance, Kwasi Kwarteng has said that he is prepared to consider a split market of the sort I've described, where fossil prices and renewables prices are kept apart. The second thing to look forward to is the government has proposed a future systems operator, which will take an overview of different networks, gas and electricity networks, and it's going to be important to see the detail of that. At the moment, the signs aren't very good because it's slightly oddly, this future systems operator is going to have different role in relation to gas and electricity, and it's going to be subordinate to both Ofgem, the regulator, and the government department concerned, which means that I think it's going to be quite difficult for it to take an independent strategic view. But we need to wait and see what sort of an outcome that particular proposal has.
Yeah, and just to remind our listeners that we are recording this on the afternoon of Wednesday, the 6th of July, during a period of considerable political uncertainty in the UK. Well, look, David and Malcolm, thank you so much for your time today. And as always, I really enjoyed our conversation that summarises the kind of the key themes and messages that came from the power-related discussions at the Energy Transition Days that were held in Oxford and live-streamed on the period 21st to 22nd of June 2022. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.